had a really interesting experience yesterday. I officiated a wedding up in Alma, and during the signing of the documents, a woman sang the song, "I Can't Help But Fall in Love With You." I can't help fall in love. You know the song, the Elvis Presley song. "I Can't Help Falling in Love With You." And during the chorus part, she invited the whole congregation to sing with her. And they did. There was like 150 people in this small little church. And this sound, it just went through the whole building. And it was just so beautiful. And then she would sing the verse, which is not very long, and then the chorus would come back. And there was something transfixing about it. And I had something of that experience this morning when I listened to you sing. I can't explain to you why church one Sunday to the next changes in its energy. Last Sunday, the energy was low. This Sunday, the energy's high. Many of the same people, some different people, but some of you, I don't understand. It's a mystery to me. But I got caught up in that moment at the church in Alma, and I could feel the presence of God in the midst of it all. And I mentioned it at the end of the service. Did you feel it? And they all nodded with a big smile. There was a celebration of love in the midst of the church. Have you ever been so absorbed into something that you lose the track of time? Has that ever happened to you? Yeah, I think probably happened to most of us. It could be a movie that you've been watching that you get so compelled with that you get drawn into it. I find that happens more in the movie theater than on the TV set, just because of the way it's set up. But it could be a play that you went to, maybe at the Stratford Festival or some small local group that puts on plays. Or maybe it was a concert you went to that just totally transfixed you and caught you up into the experience of it. You just get so caught up into it that time just disappears. And you lose track of yourself in a certain kind of way. I remember one evening a long time ago when I was a music director in a Lutheran church, we did a Stations of the Cross service in the evening of Good Friday. And I got so caught up in the story that I lost track of time. I got so caught up in Jesus' passion, the story of his passion, as it went around from station to station, that I lost track of myself. I remember looking at the clock behind me. I was in the organ console. I was playing the pipe organ at the time. I looked behind me. There's a little clock there. It was 7 o'clock when the service started. And then I looked back, and it was 8:30. And I was completely shocked by that. I was surprised. What happened to that hour and a half? I have no recollection of it other than being caught up in the experience of watching the story move from station to station, listening to it, being caught up in Jesus' passion. As I say, I lost track of time. But here's the thing, it felt so good. It felt so amazing. One of the things that I've noticed in life is that when I forget about myself, I'm usually happier. In most cases, when I'm focused on myself, when I'm consumed with myself, I'm not in a happy place. When I'm engaging with someone or something else, it's easy to lose track of myself in those moments. It's easy to lose track of time even in those places. And it's exactly in those moments that I find myself at my most happiest places. And it tells me that maybe my life isn't really about me after all. And maybe your life really isn't about you after all. Which is an intriguing thought when you think about it, because we've been taught by the world that we're a part of, the world where we live in today, that your life is about you, and my life is about me. But maybe that's not so. We live in a culture today that tends to want to encourage us to make our lives about ourselves. We're encouraged to direct our attention to our own wants and desires, to identify and focus on our own ideas and feelings. We're even told that we can't love others until we've learned how to love ourselves first. But here's the thing, even when we do all this, it often takes us to the very place that leads us away from our happiness. It takes us away from what inevitably makes us truly happy, which is forgetting about yourself. I saw this Kia car ad recently, and I'm not picking on Kia because it's everywhere. But I saw this Kia car ad, and it was focused on doing it your way. This car was going to allow you to do it your way. It was going to free you so you could do it your way. This car was about liberating you to find your own path forward in life. And it was interesting to me that in the midst of it all, it seemed to me this very process of finding your way and finding your path often takes us away from being truly happy. And I think in a way the Kia ad perfectly encapsulates what the story of Adam and Eve as found in the Bible is all about. God creates all things. God creates all things, all creatures, everything. And he culminates his creation by creating human beings. And the difference between human beings and all other creatures is that we have been endowed with the divine image, which means there's something of God in us. And we're meant to collaborate with God so as to increase the beauty and the order of nature, the beauty, the wonder of nature. And that brings with it a certain kind of moral responsibility that other creatures don't have. You know, we don't expect dolphins or ants or bees or baboons or any of the birds to have moral responsibility for creation. But we have been given that responsibility. Being made in the likeness of God means we have agency in life in a way that other creatures don't have. We get to make choices that other creatures don't get to make. And the Genesis story says that humanity is offered a choice. And I have a picture of that up there. You've seen it a few times. It's a choice to collaborate with God, and it's represented by a fruit tree. We can either trust God in his understanding of good and evil, or we can instead seize power and substitute God's understanding of good and evil with our own. It's a simple choice. We can do it God's way, which leads to life. We can make God's priorities our priorities. We can collaborate with God in making this world a better place, or we can choose to do it our own way and make life about us and our priorities, decide what's good and evil in our own framework, make the focal point of life about us, you, me. And the Bible says that when we make that decision, if we choose to go down that path, it will lead to death. It's not without consequences, and it's not just death for us. It really impairs and subjugates the creation itself. You know, I was reading an article that says birth rates in Canada have been plummeting for a long time. When I was born, it was common to have families of 2, 3, 4 kids, more even. 3 and 4 was not uncommon. Then it became 2 kids per family. That was the ideal family. And then it later became 1 child per family. And now many young adults have decided not to have children at all. And there are many reasons for this. I know there are many reasons. The financial challenge of raising a family today is probably harder than it's ever been. The housing costs really, they really impact on the ability for young people to have families. But I think a very big reason for the declining birth rate among our population is that parenting is unattractive to many young people today. Because when you have children, you cannot remain exclusively focused on yourself and your own story. You have to become a supporting actor in another person's life. Your life isn't only about you anymore. And I can hear Shani out there with her daughter. That's proof of point. Shani probably wanted to stay in church, but she had to commit herself to serving her daughter. In fact, I remember one parent saying to me that when he held his firstborn in his arms for the first time, he realized that his old life was over, that it was never, ever going to come back to him either. His old identity was over with his firstborn child. He had moved from being the star of his own story to being a supporting actor in the life of another. And so many young people today are simply refusing to make the journey into parenthood because they don't want to accept the demotion that comes with being a parent. Because they've been encouraged to believe by the culture, by advertisers, by their peers and families that their life is really about them. And that might explain also why in the polls so many young people are filled with anxiety and depression and fear. We've taught them that their life is about them, when in fact true happiness is found in a different place. There are many types of poetry. I'm not sure how many of you are interested in poetry, but there are many types. One type is called lyric poetry. It's the dominant form of poetry today. It's the type of poetry that you are all familiar with, even if you don't know the terminology. Lyric poetry is found in almost every pop song out there. You know the song, "I Can't Help Falling in Love with You." I can't help falling in love with you. There's Barrett Browning's famous poem, "How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Ways." These are both examples of lyric poetry. 10cc did a song long ago called "I'm Not in Love." I'm not in love, so don't forget it. It's just a silly phase I'm going through. Do you see the connection? You picked up on that yet? Lyric poetry focuses on a single person's experience. There's a lot of I statements in lyric poetry. I feel this. I believe this. I love you. I hate you. I want you. I don't want you. The focal point of lyric poetry is on the speaker. It's all about the I. And lyric poetry has a place in our lives, absolutely. It's an important part of our experience. But we need to understand lyric poetry is really about the self. And the more obsessed we become with the self, the more we raise up the importance of our own experience, the more importance we place on our thoughts and feelings, the more important this kind of poetry becomes in our culture, which is why it's everywhere. It's everywhere. You can't escape lyric poetry today. It's even found in our church songs. There's a lot of lyric poetry today in our church songs. I love you, God. I love you, Lord. We live in a lyrical world where we have become obsessed with ourselves, where everything seems to be about keeping a running tab on our feelings and our sense of self-worth. And personally, I'm exhausted by it. I'm exhausted by it. Today, I hunger for a story bigger than myself, a story that I can get lost in, a story that I can find my home in, a story where I begin to learn how to forget myself in a good way, for a time at least. Do any of you feel that at all? It's time to start forgetting about ourselves in a good way. The Bible is not about the lyrical world at all. It's an epic story. It's a big story. It's a story where big things matter, where big things are being worked out, where the little I doesn't really mean that much to it. You and I are not the focal point of the Christian story. The Christian story is about God. It's about how God goes about trying to repair the rupture between himself and humankind. First by hiring Israel and then finally deciding to do it himself when Israel fails. The Christian story is meant to lift you and me out of our personal story, to bring us into a much bigger drama, a story where we are meant to put ourselves on the back burner, at least for a time, for a moment, so we can watch the bigger drama of life being played out before us, in us, around us. The Christian story is where the little I gets brought into the big we. Last week, we talked about the Christian story, and I laid out seven simple scenes. And I'm still refining the titles each week, each step of the way, each story, each scene. So I've reframed them again. Here they are here. And that's as big as I can make on one slide, so hopefully you can see some of it. But the Christian story has seven scenes. Scene one, humanity fires God. Scene two, God hires Israel to bring people back home. Scene three, Israel quits or is fired, depending on who you talk to. Scene four, God takes up the job himself through Jesus by coming as Jesus. Scene five, humanity blocks God by crucifying his son to a cross. Scene six, God rehires Jesus by raising him to new life. And scene seven, the church shares the story of Jesus with the world until he returns. Pretty simple, isn't it? We fire God. God's not going to let himself be fired. You can't fire God, really, can you? So we try to fire God. God hires Israel to bring that rupture, to heal that rupture. Israel either quits or is fired. And then God comes in Jesus. We crucify Jesus to the cross in an attempt to fire God again, and then God rehires Jesus, won't let that firing of Jesus be the final story. And then ultimately, we are here today carrying forward the story of Jesus to the world. And we've talked a lot about the first step, humanity fires God. That's what last Sunday service was about, and I've already talked a little bit about this with you already. We've already gone over this feature of the Christian story this morning, the relationship with God and humankind is broken. That's the foundational gist of the story, the beginning of the plot, you might say. It got broke, that relationship between God and humanity, when we elevated ourselves into God's position in our lives. Because the original design was meant to be a collaboration between God and humankind. We were made in the image of God. We were meant to collaborate with God. Part of God is living within us. God would do his job and we would do our job, and through this collaboration, the world would be brought into a greater reality of wonder and beauty and order, good order. That's what God intended. But humankind decided that wasn't quite good enough. Yes, we would do our job, but we want also to do God's job. We wanted both jobs. And so we fired God and hired ourselves in God's place, and this is when the rupture took place. That's the beginning assumption of the story, of the Christian story. When we decided that our lives were about us, your life was about you, my life was about me, and so we seized both positions in our lives. We seized the God position and the human position. And that rupture is still unfolding today. You just have to look around the world to see that. We're still seizing both positions again and again and again. And in a way, it seems like we're getting into a harder place about this, because all the roadblocks that regulate the ego in our culture are being torn down. All the guardrails that keep us on the good path are being knocked over. We're good at unleashing the passion of the self. We're good at laying out our desires. But we're not really good at the virtue of self-restraint and self-limit. And we're watching this all unfold before us. This is the world of Babylon. I've got a slide there for you. This is the world of Babylon there that the Bible talks about. If it's allowed to go unchecked, if we keep elevating ourselves into the God position, it's just going to keep growing and growing and growing, and we're going to take everything down with us. Everything. And God does not want this to happen. As the paramount artist, his creation is precious to him. So he begins to look for a way for our return back. God cannot leave humanity unleashed into the world. We have so much power given to us because we're made in the divine image. So God is not going to give up on us, even when a major diversion comes to him. So God begins casting about, and he decides to pick a people who will represent him in the world, and they will be his ambassadors and emissaries to all people. And the people he chose to represent him in the world is called Israel. In fact, God chooses Israel before they even exist. They don't even exist when God decides to choose Israel amongst all the peoples and nations of the world. And we have to go back to a further time before Israel even exists, back to a man named Abram. In fact, we have to go back to his father, Terach, because it seems that the original call that came to Abram was originally offered to his father, Terach. Terach and his family lived in the city of Ur, in the land of the Chaldeans. Ur is one of the oldest cities that we know of today. It's almost 4,000 years old. Ur goes right back to the beginning of civilization. It's the very foundation of human civilization. And in the city of Ur lived a man named Terach, and God called him to leave Ur and go to the promised land of Canaan. And so Terach uprooted his family, which included Abram and his wife and his daughter-in-law Sarah, and they began this long trek to Canaan, thousands of kilometers. But about halfway there, they stopped in the city of Haran to regroup. And at Haran, they decided not to go forward. Terach decided to settle in Haran, and that's where he died. And God's plan was stymied for the moment. But when Terach died, God came to his son Abram. And this is where our story in Genesis 12 picks up. God makes a promise of sorts with Abram. He declares to him that if he goes to the promised land that God has given to him, God will make Abram into a great nation. Abram's descendants will become a blessing to the world. And Abram hears God's call, and unlike his father, he fulfills it to its full completion. He goes to the promised land of Canaan. And from Abram, we get Isaac, and from Isaac, we get Jacob. And from Jacob, we get by the brook, by the ford of Jabbok, we get a transformation as Jacob wrestles with God. And he's renamed by God and called Israel, he who struggles with God. And Israel's born. The people that God has chosen to represent him in the world are finally born into reality. And the story moves from Jacob through Joseph to Moses, finally into the Sinai desert where God makes a covenant with the people of Israel. And as Israel is commissioned to be God's representatives, they are called to do so in four distinct ways. And I've got that on a slide up there. These are the four characteristics of Israel. They are meant to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They are meant to be a distinct people set apart for God as special intermediaries between God and all nations. Israel is meant to be a light to the nations. God intended for Israel to witness to other peoples about him and his covenant through their devotion and way of life. Israel was meant to be the lineage for the Messiah when God's anointed one would come to save the whole world. And finally, Israel was meant to be stewards of God's truth. Israel was entrusted with guarding and sharing God's holy word and all the laws. They were entrusted to hold on to these laws and God's way and then to share them with the world. They were meant to represent God's care to all people. And through Israel's example, they were meant to help other peoples, all nations, know who the one true God is and to worship this one true God and ultimately to repair the rupture that had happened between God and all people. See, the Bible is telling an epic story. It's a big story. It's built on first principles. It has overarching themes, and it's principally about God and what God's up to in life.